Blog Talk Radio. World Community, Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. On Wednesdays, join us as we explore heart health and homeopathy, a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brooks and Dr. Adil Chinsalawala, MD homeopath specializing in cardiology. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go! Hi, I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community. Today is September 21, 2011. You're listening to show number 2 with our co-host, Dr. Adil Chinsalawala Kasim, MD, the fourth generation homeopath. And in our shows, we're going to love to receive your questions so that Dr. Adil can directly answer them. Today, we're having a pre-recording. Over the course of the sessions, we're going to learn a tremendous amount of information. And I'm interested to know how the Indian government integrates homeopathy into the healthcare system. We might get to that one of these days, but today, we're going to talk about hypertension, your heart and your health. Maybe this is how you originally got interested in your specialty, Dr. Adil.
Yeah, Debbie. Right from the very beginning, I had an inclination towards cardiology. And as time progressed, when I was in medical school, I thought that many people, even after doing an angiography, even after taking a lot of antihypertensive drugs, clearing the blocks, still come about and the same complaints, say for a year, 2 years, 3 years, still the hypertension is not very well controlled. Can we do something else? And that was when I turned to homeopathy. Of course, being a fourth generation homeopath, that means it was already in my family since 1912. And my great-grandfather actually brought homeopathy to Central India. And since then, it has continued, and all facets of homeopathy we are delving into. Well, when two very interesting incidents happened in my life, what prompted me to come to homeopathy? When first I was doing my residency in the medical college, there were two patients in the intensive cardiac care unit. One was suffering from left ventricular failure. I remember, 48 years old female, having an ejection fraction, that is a fraction of the heart, pumping capacity of the heart, which should normally be up to 80%, that had reduced to 8%, and she was battling for life. And in spite of all the measures in the ICU, she could not come up. That was once when I suggested to my ICU in charge, if homeopathy could help. And at that time, I remember using Convallaria Majalis in increasing potencies, and from 8% to 22%, the ejection fraction came up. So this itself was a very big boost. Yes, homeopathy does act, and it acts in grave cardiac disorders. Second, what happened was, a patient of unstable angina, continuously complaining, a 70 years old man who had undergone a bypass, but the angina couldn't stop. He used to report at our hospital, medical college hospital, but he was not getting any relief. Then again, I suggested that why don't we start homeopathy? So all his allopathic medications were stopped, and gradually we gave him Aurum Med, I remember, Aurum Med 30. And from then on, he started feeling absolutely well. His angina disappeared hardly within the 1 month. And these two great incidents prompted me, no, there is something in homeopathy which is untapped. It should be focused upon, hence homeopathy cardiology.
Wow, that's a great story. One of these days, we're going to have to do a whole show about your grandfather coming to India. I would love to hear that. And about the remedies that you used, when you first started with these two cases, did you get someone else to come and assist you?
Exactly. My father himself is a very great homeopath. I mean, out here in India, he's very well known. And he is also an MD from modern medicine. I mean, from allopathy, he shifted to homeopathy. So, basically, education system here out is, I mean, the grounding for MBBS, for the basic medical course is so strong, and we have got so many patients out here that it was wiser to do MBBS allopathy first and then shift on to homeopathy. Of course, there is a direct course in homeopathy, but then we did, both my father and myself, first did allopathy. And he was the one who helped me out in those days. And because he helped me out, yes, that day, today I have got lots of confidence, and thankfully I can treat exclusively homeopathy cardiology patients with homeopathy.
That's quite amazing. And how I noticed that you have the two remedies that you selected. One was a plant, and the other one was a mineral.
Mineral, yeah.
Right, and you were watching these remedies work very rapidly?
See, when you read about them, it's a different story. But when you actually give them and you see the results, an evidence-based result, I mean, in an ICC, you can see the results in front of everyone. You have got ECGs, you've got echocardiograms, you've got angiograms, everything to prove that your medicine had acted and the previous medicine which you had given, that allopathic medication, had failed to act. And that is why it was a miracle. It was something to boost up one's confidence that something great is there in homeopathy, which unfortunately has been marginally tapped or untapped as yet.
Right. But you do feel like the MD, the allopathic education that you received is also very important for your practice.
Yeah, because here in India, the grounding, the system of allopathy, the basic education curriculum is so well designed, it gives enough a confidence after 5.5 years to handle any sort of cases, chronic or acute emergencies. I mean, that has really helped me in gaining a foothold, what the human body is, what is the human mind, much, much more deeper. And we can clearly prove what we are doing. We just go and say it's a feeling of well-being. Oh, no, it is an evidence-based homeopathy, it is evidence-based medicine, and it is a scientific homeopathy. And this itself is a very, very big thing.
Everybody's going to ask that question. So where is the data to prove, right? And so do you have a collection of many years' worth of files and statistics that can show others? Yeah.
Yeah. The same thing which I presented Liga when I was at U.S., the Liga Congress, and this time again in the Liga Congress in Delhi, we have presented all the statistic data, how many we have collected, different types of cardiac cases do we get, how do we approach, and what are the statistics, which remedies for acutes, which remedies for emergencies, which remedies for chronic cases have helped us the most. Of course, homeopathy is holistic, homeopathy is individualistic, so remedies change from patient to patient. It doesn't change from disease to disease, but it does change from patient to patient. That I agree. But then statistics have been developed, statistics give, and they're open. I mean, we have published them in practically many souvenirs and magazines, and the government of India also has given due recognition for that, those same.
Well, it's wonderful that your government listens, because that's not always the case for in other countries. They're not always paying attention. But they should know that when you say that you presented your evidence and some of these cases at the Liga, what that organization is, the Liga Medicorum Homeopathica Internationalis, is an organization of all MDs around the world who get together and have a Congress and share their knowledge. And they probably do much more that I'm not aware of. Last year it was in California, and this coming December the program is going to be in New Delhi from December 1st through 4th, 2011.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's a Congress just not for meeting people, but bringing homeopathy to much more scientific level, much more evidence-based. A great amount of discussion is there, and it definitely opens up new corridors for homeopathy to be spread, and a future course of homeopathy could be decided by such Congress, where throughout the world, different systems, I mean, different approaches to homeopathy, they come around, and we have a very healthy discussion around there. A great hall of learning.
Well, I'm looking forward to all of the MDs who practice homeopathy to really spread the word to their colleagues. So tell me more about hypertension and your approach.
Yeah, exactly. Now, hypertension, basically, I mean, of course, from modern medicine point of view, it is hypertension when your blood pressure raises to X amount. I mean, for example, there are two types of hypertension. The upper one is called systolic. The lower one is called diastolic. Now, WHO has given up different sets that what is a hypertension, which levels of systolic BP and which levels of diastolic BP can be termed as hypertension. I am not going to go into that detail. What is most important is in homeopathy, or any holistic system of medicine, we consider not hypertension per se, but we consider what is called as hypertensive state. It's a state of the body. It's a state wherein the mind and the body together are involved. Both are in tensive state. Both have stressed out, and they are showing it on the body in the form of raised blood pressure.
So this can happen at any age?
Yes, right from birth till death. I mean, it can happen at any age, and no age is barred. Initially, when we used to consider hypertension, it was only for older age groups, but now we are finding in practically any age. Recently, yesterday itself, I had a case of a young boy, aged 18 years. The only thing he complained was heaviness of head when he was rising up from the pillow. And he used to say that my pillow is pulling me down whenever I get. That's the only symptom I have. I don't know why I'm having this.
Fascinating. Go ahead.
So he had just come with his mother, not for his complaint, but for his mother's complaint. And just when I was checking the BP of his mother, he also told me, "Doctor, can you check my blood pressure as well?" That was just for the heck of it. I mean, he's not come as a patient. Well, when I measured this 18-year-old boy, and the blood pressure was 210 by 110. The normal blood pressure at this age, you would expect 120 systolic and diastolic 80, plus minus 10. Now, I was surprised. I took in his one right arm, then left arm, in the sleeping posture, in sitting posture. No change. The BP was as high. And he had absolutely no symptoms other than the only symptom was that my pillow pulls me down when I try to wake up. I told him, "Do you have a family history?" Because his mother does not have hypertension. His father does not have hypertension. And we were perplexed. Why actually this gentleman has got hypertension? Then I prescribed certain tests. One of the most important tests here carried out a simple urine examination and a sonography to see the vessel, I mean the kidney size and the kidney shape, as well as the vessel supplying the kidney, the renal vessel. Now, what we found out was he had got renal hypertension. That means to say that his renal artery was stenosed. Renal artery, the diameter of renal artery has decreased. And that is the reason. So at the end of the day, he had come early in the morning at 11 o'clock. By 6 o'clock, we got all the reports. And it was proved that the young boy had got renal hypertension. Such a sorry state of health. Now, this is not a case. There are many, many cases out there. And now when we want to start treatment, therapy for such patients, in allopathy it becomes very difficult because we have to go on increasing and increasing the doses, and yet not, the BP may or may not be controlled.
It's a totally different way of looking at the human being. And when you looked at him, he was not overweight. He was not anxious. He was not in any way looking like there was any kind of outward sign.
None. He was a very calm, cheerful person. I mean, very good to talk to, lean, and hardly weighing 52 kgs. For 18 years, 52 kgs is probably all right. And his diet, appetite, his basic generals, what we call physical generals, appetite, sleep, thirst, everything else was within normal limits. No apparent change. Neither, see, in renal hypertension, one of the first symptoms we have is swelling. Swelling either above the lids or below the eyelids or swelling over the legs. But not any of these complaints were present in that patient. The only symptom, and that too after much asking, was that, doctor, I don't have any symptoms. You are saying that I have got hypertension, but I don't feel anything. Now, it becomes quite difficult to disclose the diagnosis to such a patient who doesn't have symptoms. So these are called silent disorders, and silent hypertension is now an epidemic. I mean, hypertension basically is an epidemic in Indian subcontinent, not only in India, but Indian subcontinent, right from Pakistan, Nepal, of course, India is included, Thailand, Burma, and down Sri Lanka, throughout. Not only that, but Indians residing abroad, non-resident Indians residing in US, UK, when they come to India, we measure their blood pressure. It's definitely more than what they used to have in India. So probably, and now again, genetics play a role. Hypertension is ruling the roost.
So for this young boy, he was lucky because he came in with his mom and was helping her and then just inquired, and you were good enough to take his blood pressure and pulse and everything else. But most of the people, when they have a silent disorder of this nature, do you recommend then that everyone in some way go to a physician and have their blood pressure checked or some specific kind of diagnostic?
Yeah. I mean, now, see, for example, we keep on having the Rotary International here. I'm also a Rotarian.
Okay.
And the National Academy of Homeopathy India. Together, we have got lots of camps, practically every Sunday or every 2 weeks or so. We conduct camps in children for two important reasons. One is to detect such silent disorders like hypertension and obesity. Obesity in childhood can be easily controlled, and hypertension, if detected in childhood, can be easily controlled. The complications can be reversed. The complications may not be allowed to happen. And in hardly 300 students, I mean, last week itself, we conducted a Rotary camp at one of the schools. We conducted, I mean, that was essentially for anemia. Anemia is also another problem which we have encountered quite frequently. So, and I'll be also surprised to find that seven people of 300 were hypertensive, and they were not realizing it. And one eventually turned out to be hypothyroid. Along with hypertension, three other people were having anemia, severe anemia with hypertension, and they were totally unaware. Neither were the parents, neither were the doctors. Ultimately, we had to write to the doctors, the pediatricians, to take care. And I gave them an option for homeopathy to be open. If your doctors don't take care, you can shift on to homeopathy and we will control the same. So, I mean, it's such a common disorder, hypertension. So hypertension suddenly doesn't develop. Hypertension has got a pre-hypertensive state, then hypertension disease proper, and hypertensive complications. So there are three different states. Hypertension in its pre-stage, that is pre-hypertensive stage, gives you subtle signs and symptoms, which if the physician or the pediatrician is aware or homeopath is aware, can easily, or even the parent or the patient himself is aware, then one can catch hypertension quite easily. Now, what are those signals and signs? One of the first symptoms and signs are change in your physical generals, what we call. That is change in sleeping patterns. For example, I have basically a very good sleep. But since past 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, it's continuing. That I feel sleepy the entire day. And I don't do anything about it. Then, where I sleep well for 8 hours, but I don't feel that I have slept well. That's unrefreshed sleep. Then disturbed sleep, and finally the sleep goes away. Doctor, I can't sleep. I mean, it takes a long time. I go to bed at 10 o'clock, but I get sleep at 1 a.m. So if this is the situation, this is one of the things leading to a hypertensive state. Second would be stools, constipation with sleep. These are the two symptoms, and third symptom is urination, particularly nocturia, that is urination, more frequent urination at night. If initially I would be able to control my urination for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, the urge for urination, but today I have to rush, it's a sign that something wrong is going into my body.
Mm-hmm.
So these three things at symptomatic level, one should be able to tell the doctor himself or herself, doctor, kindly check my blood pressure or at least the blood sugar. Both diabetes and hypertension in the earlier stages are very similar to, in presentations. May not be particularly that every time the BP may be high. Sometimes it is high, sometimes normal. But one should make it sure that he or she takes his blood pressure in random parts of the day. For example, once early in the morning, or once at night, once in the daytime, once while with one doctor, sometimes another doctor with another instrument. So why a benefit of doubt, what we call, should be given to the patient before we actually diagnose hypertension. And this is very difficult. Particularly many people have got raised blood pressure only in the evenings. After the office hours, they come home. Only then at that time they have got hypertension. Some people have got only morning hypertension. Otherwise, the whole day they are all right. Now, if these people who have got only periodic hypertensive raise, BP raise, if the patient is having hypertension only in the evening, if they're detected in the morning, the BP will come normal. So he or she will say that I am not hypertensive. Or even the doctor will say. Such situations need to be seen from a broader perspective. And simple blood pressure detection is important, but in different parts of the day, and span should be over a week or 2 weeks.
That is very educational. You just gave me a whole education on hypertension. So we have to look at the sleep pattern, the stool and the urine, and then also give the benefit of the doubt, because I know there's white coat syndrome. So that maybe the person's blood pressure goes up only when they go to the doctor. And would that be also considered hypertension?
Yes. White coat hypertension is a very good entity for homeopaths. See, particularly hypertension means that acute stress of going to the doctor and an apprehension that I will be detected hypertension or a hypertensive ailment would be present. That itself leads to raised blood pressure. But for homeopaths, for allopaths, it may not be important to prescribe. But for homeopaths, we are definitely sure that this gentleman or this lady who is a white coat hypertension, in our language we call Argentine nitricum patients or type A personalities or sanguineous personalities, nervous sanguineous personalities or temperaments, these people go in for white coat hypertension and they are hyper. Practically in all other arenas as well. Such patients in homeopathy require Nux Vomica or for that matter Gelsenium or Argentine Nitricum, and they respond quite very well. So yes, white coat hypertension cannot be neglected by homeopaths because we have a treatment for those patients as well. It may not be a physical symptom, but it's definitely a mental symptom.
Right, because it's such a different perspective on the total human being that we look at how the mind and the body affect one another. And so you're saying if there's anticipation, anxiety before an exam or before a performance or something of that nature. And so Gelsenium we know is good for that and Argent Night. And what about the Nux Vomica?
Nux Vomica persons are basically all hyper persons. I mean, mm-hmm. They are hurried and worried as well. All these three remedies, Nux Vomica also. Nux Vomica is a very short-tempered remedy, bursts out. Nux Vomica has one very bad symptom. see many times nowadays in case of white collarship, I mean, if you can't speak to people as freely as you used to do, say about say 50 years ago or 100 years ago, you have to see your social etiquettes and everything so you can't just speak out freely. In such scenarios, Naksvamika has one remedy which has short temper but is an expressive short temper, as opposed to Staphylococcus, which is again short tempered but a non-expressive short temper. Now, in both these remedies, Staphylococcus and Naksvamika, the temper expression is there or not there, but after the temper is gone, both these remedies continuously brood about small trifles, and that brooding causes, it is not like natural mood brooding, which broods for a long, long time on grief. But short, these trifles, these brooding, actually spoil the day of Naksvamika and Staphylococcus and ultimately cause hypertension or hyperglycemia, whatever.
So I'm trying to understand the difference between those remedies now that you kind of got it started. So the difference between Nature Muriaticum is it's more chronic or long term, that there's a, it's for, they're brooding over a grief, but not have, do they still have this temper or this anger that is within, or do they express it?
Natramur basically is a non-expressive person. What we find Natramur, just see the remedy and the salt, what we have, so much similarity which we have. Take the common salt. A common salt is a property that is white in color, it is crystal, fine. When it's taken in the body, it retains. Retention is one of the prime features of Natrum Muriaticum, both in its physical state as well as when it is acting as a remedy. Now, how retention? When Natrum Muriaticum is in excess in the body, physically, it retains water. Likewise, when the remedy is proved on a human being, at the spiritual level or the mental structure, it retains unnecessary thoughts. It can't let go. And it retains for a long, long time without doing anything about it. It just retains. It just broods. Natrum is basically reserved. It can't communicate so freely with others. So even in a crowd, Natramur is by himself or herself absolutely lonely. Even disappointed love, what we call. I mean, Natramur falls in love with, Kent has written that the lady falls in love with a coachman. Natramur likes people who are less egoistic than himself or herself. So it loves plants, it loves animals, it loves dogs, it loves pets, anything the ego of which is less. Anything which will not retaliate, anything or anyone which will not hurt him or her, or will not be dishonest to him. No, Natramur cannot bear dishonesty absolutely. So that it will not be grieved, and if it not be grieved, it will not brood over. So retention is one of the important features. Likewise for constipation, likewise for sex. Natramur can't express freely. It retains, and then brings on psychosomatic disorders like hypertension, and hyperglycemia. That is hypertension. That's why the chief remedy, one of the chief remedies in homeopathy for hypertension and atherosclerosis and other sort of metabolic disorders.
Thank you very much. That was a great explanation about Nature Muriaticum. And may I ask about potencies, or do you want to talk about something else?
You can go on.
I mean, it's, Nature Muriaticum is probably given quite often for a person who has hypertension if they have edema and this tendency to retain or hold on to their thoughts and not be able to express. So would this be a remedy that you would give on a long-term basis in a low potency, even a 6X, or would you be giving it in a higher potency? Or does it depend upon the individual?
No, it depends upon the individual why I'm giving Natramur. See, in homeopathy, it depends why I'm treating. Now, what is my purpose of treating? There are two different types of homeopathic treatment. If you have read aphorism number 76, Hahnemann clearly says that homeopathy, the great benevolent, has given us homeopathy for natural cases, for curing natural diseases. Now, we have to differentiate between natural cases and unnatural cases. That means there are two different types of cases, natural and unnatural. Natural cases are those cases where we have got a good set of physical generals, altered physical generals and altered mental state. If you don't have good physical generals, if you don't have altered mental states, or if the mental state is altered because of great pathology, then that case becomes unnatural. For example, hypertension belongs to a natural case, whereas congenital heart disease or a ventricular septal defect would belong to an unnatural case or a case which is incurable. Now, natural cases should be given constitutional homeopathic drugs. That means all the physical generals, the mental generals should be taken into account, as well as particulars, that is the particular symptom set with which the patient has come into account. If you take all these into account, then a drug selected would be a constitutional drug. It is highly individualistic. And in that sense, natremur has to be given in very high potencies, not very high, but high potencies, started with, say, 200 over 1 M, and then may ascend. Or if you start in millisimal potencies, 0 by 1, 0 by 3 max, and then ascend up. But very infrequent doses, once a month or twice a month, or once in 2 months, or probably one dose may suffice. So that is the power of constitutional drug. What does it do? Constitutional drug as a whole will bring down the miasmatic state, the miasm which we discussed last time. It brings down the active miasmatic state to a latent state, and thereby all the symptoms at the spiritual level, the mental level, and the physical plane, they are at bay. And they're kept at bay for a pretty long time. Now, for this action of constitutional remedy to continue for years together, we need to repeat give a nosode or an intercurrent remedy like Medorinum or carcinosin or tuberculinum, which all these follow natremur very well. So this is as far as the constitutional prescription is concerned. Natremur can also be given as an acute prescription only for either tapering of one of the symptoms of hypertension, for example, swelling below the lids, the swelling on the legs, or profuse urination, or a headache because of hypertension. Single symptoms, for that we require to give low potencies and frequent repetitions.
Very good. So frequent repetitions would be even daily, and that would be low potency would be a 6X, 6C, or even a 30C?
Yeah, exactly. Very low, but less than 30, because if you start giving high potencies over a long period of time, you actually conduct a proving, which we don't want.
Okay, so it's safe to do a low potency, like a cell salt, tissue salt, a potency over a longer period of time.
Exactly.
Okay, and this is in an acute situation where we're seeing this swelling in the body.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you had mentioned incurable types of cases, like unnatural hypertensive cases or heart defects, things like that. And, you hear these stories of really great athletes in high school that are on the field. They do something and they drop dead right there from a heart attack and nobody knew anything about it.
Yeah, no, these people now would have already have a silent disorder going inside, but they have had no complaints. Like the boy which I've just mentioned, that 18-year-old boy,
right.
He is basically an athlete, but he has had no complaints. This was just an accidental detection. So, I am talking about unnatural cases where pathology is far advanced. For example, congenital heart disorders or congenital kidney diseases, where it is impossible to cure this patient. We can only palliate. In such cases, we need to give very low potencies and frequent repetitions. It can be, say twice a day. It can be daily. It can be twice a week. However, that it depends upon the patient, how the control is to be achieved.
Okay. Well, we have completed about a half an hour, and it's been absolutely fantastic. And the sound has been so clear and lovely. Is there anything else that you would like to say? And then we will continue on in the following week.
Yeah, one more thing. Talking about incurable cases, one exception in palliation is pregnancy-induced hypertension. Pregnancy-induced hypertension is a place where only the blood pressure has to come down, whatever it takes. Of course, the final treatment is the delivery of the child. Once the child is delivered, the BP comes down. But in homeopathy, like we also, my mother is a homeopathic gynecologist, and we conduct deliveries and cases. So we do have PIH cases of pregnancy-induced hypertension. And if the BP is not brought down, the patient goes into convulsions, what we call eclampsia. In such cases, we need to give doses of natremoor, very high potency, again, frequent repetition. So this is an exception to the rule that low potency is frequent repetition in general cases. But in particular situations, which we call accelerated hypertension, we need to give very high potencies, even CM potencies or 10M potencies, and that too every hourly interval till the BP comes down and we achieve a so-called manageable state. So this is an exception to the rule.
This is such important information for people to know because they don't have any other alternative, really, besides doing the homeopathy, or I don't know what else they would give for a woman who is pregnant with this hypertension. I don't know. Do they say bed rest, or what would they normally say?
Allopathy, they give magnesium sulfate. Magnesium sulfate injections are given. That controls blood pressure to a great extent.
Okay.
And the routine antihypertensive drugs. But the final treatment is delivery of the baby. So
okay.
They just manage BP somehow. Even homeopathy also we can manage, but this is an exception that even the patient is pregnant, although the drug may affect the child as well as the mother, but still higher potencies need to be given with frequent repetition starting from 9th month of the gestation period. Not before that.
Okay, so do you want to give us a heads up on what's going to be for the next week, or are we going to figure that out later?
Well, I believe that we continue. Hypertension is still not finished. We have a long topic.
Okay.
We have to talk about diet and hypertension. We have to talk about mind and hypertension. And we have to talk about evolution of hypertension, complications of hypertension, and the role of homeopathy. I mean, hypertension is a huge, huge topic. And, of course, when we're talking about hypertension, we are covering partly symptoms of other cardiac disorders also. So that should be the topic again for the next week.
Excellent. Well, thank you. This has been just wonderful, and I would like to wish you a happy birthday as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Debbie. It is actually a very beautiful birthday present for me, talking to you, and from the other part of the world, people wishing me. I mean, so, so great to celebrate a birthday. Actually, I was telling my children and my wife that although I was late for the party yesterday night, but still, my present was waiting for you.
Well, I'm really thrilled that you're on, and the world is getting to hear these words and learn more about homeopathy and how it can help in just about any situation, whether it's palliation or tending toward cure.
Exactly. It's the skills and the knowledge one should use and the applications, and then you see the miracles of any pathy. Why homeopathy? But any pathy, be it Reiki, be it holistic healing, be it spiritual healing, be it homeopathy. But whatever it has to be done sustained, focused, and very well skilled.
What a lovely ending.
Thank you for listening to Heart Health and Homeopathy with co-host Dr. Adel Jim Salawala and Debbie Bruck on Homeopathy World Community Radio.